Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. I've been called a redneck a time or two, and it never really bothered me. And I had no idea the term redneck began during West Virginia's mine wars.
They didn't speak the same language. They did not have the same culture. And they were fighting each other and divided. But when they tied on these bandanas and marched, they became a brotherhood.
While the Unionists were charging that mountain and dodging airstrikes and sniper fire by way of the federal government and coal interests, they all pulled out their red scarves and tied them around their necks, not only as a way of identifying each other, but as a badge of honor. And out of that small but bloody piece of American history arose the great American term, redneck.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for tuning in. You're one of the growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. In our show today, we're traveling down to Mingo County, West Virginia, to talk about a sensitive topic in our region, the mine wars. This past weekend, over 500 people visited Matewan, West Virginia, to catch a glimpse of a brand new museum. It memorializes a dark and bloody time in West Virginia's labor history. In the early 1900s, coal miners in southern West Virginia were fighting for the right to organize and to stop the practice of using mine guards. They also wanted an alternative to shopping at coal company stores and being paid in scrip instead of money.
The lot of the miner at best is quite hard. We work for good money, get paid with a card. We scarcely can live and not a cent more, since we're paid off in checks on the company store.
So miners with the United Mine Workers of America organized a series of strikes, which led up to the climactic march on Blair Mountain in 1921.
The people who led the Battle of Blair Mountain came from the base of my mountain, Bill Blizzard. He was 58 years old and led a march of 10,000 miners to Battle of Blair. He wrote a book called When Miners March, and he used all his dad's facts and figures and everything. I knew these people, Bill. I knew him. He used to come to the house, you know, be with my dad a lot, running around, and his young men, you know. It ain't like they wasn't even here before. It was real. It's something that happened, you know. And from people to mark it off like it never happened, like it never existed.
That was the late Larry Gibson, who was interviewed by Michael and Carrie Klein back in 2011. That interview was part of a radio documentary called Remembering Blair Mountain by Miranda Brown. Bill Blizzard helped lead the army of miners to march on Blair Mountain in 1921, but the mine wars were a series of violent strikes that went on for decades. Now, this history is honored at a museum. Our producer, Roxy Todd, brings us this report from the grand opening of the new West Virginia Mine Wars Museum.
Tell it in the country, tell it in the town. Miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillar, load another ton, or lift another finger till a union we have won. Stand up, boys, and let the bosses.
Amid the sultry humidity, crowds of people came to see the new West Virginia Mine Wars Museum for the first time. Some visitors shed tears as they filed through the exhibits.
My name's Dave Hatfield. I'm the great-great-nephew of Sid Hatfield. He was the police chief here in Matewan back in 1920, and he was involved in the shootout out back here. He was police chief here in town. So this Mine Wars Museum really means a lot to me, and to this town, and to this whole area. And I'm just grateful for all the people that's worked on it, took their time and blood, sweat, and tears to make it possible. And if everybody could, I'd like for them to come down and see it because it's something to behold.
David's ancestor, Sid Hatfield, has come to represent many things for the people of Matewan, depending on who's telling the story. For most people, Sid Hatfield became a hero who stood up for the families of striking miners. But for the coal company owners and the Baldwin Felt agents who opposed him, he was seen as a lawless, renegade cop.
So the Baldwin-Felts agents approached Sid Hatfield and Mayor Testerman by the railroad tracks behind where our museum is.
Historian Lou Martin is a board member of the new West Virginia Mine Wars Museum.
And just as they reenact every year here in Mate 1, the two groups of men had a tense standoff with the Baldwin-Felts agents asserting that they had a warrant for Sid Hatfield's arrest, and the mayor insisting that their papers were bogus or falsified.
Nobody is sure which side fired first back in 1920, but a gunfight erupted beside the railroad tracks in downtown Mate 1. Some of those bullet holes are still visible in the bricks in the back of the new Mine Wars Museum. Beside the bullet holes, there's also an audio exhibit where visitors can hear the story firsthand from interviews with Mate 1 residents.
I saw at least 20 people come out of Mate 1 and swim.
These interviews, as well as countless artifacts from the Mine Wars, have been collected by local historians throughout the years. But there hasn't been a local museum to curate them until now.
All through the decades, there have been people, especially locally, trying to preserve this history, trying to honor it. We feel them cheering us on, and we know that a lot of people have been working towards something like this for a long time.
And some of those local people who've been working to preserve the Mine Wars history for many years joined up with young historians and organizers to build the new museum.
I'm Wilma Lee Steele, and I'm one of the board members for the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum. I was born on Buffalo Creek and grew up at Red Jacket, went to school at Mate 1. So all of this history here is important to me.
Steele is a retired art teacher. For her, the passion of sharing the history started from telling young activists about the history behind the word redneck and the red bandana, that striking miners tied red bandanas around their necks during the march on Blair Mountain.
The thing that I guess that gets me, that makes me want to do this and tell other people about this, is that all those immigrants from all these different countries, they didn't speak the same language, they did not have the same culture, and they were fighting each other and divided. But when they tied on these bandanas and marched, they became a brotherhood. You know, and one of the things that I love the best about the Union is that the Union was one of the early ones that says same pay for blacks and whites. It's pretty special.
It was strange growing up with this history, because when I was first learning about it, this history was not being celebrated at all.
That's Chuck Keeney, a history professor at Southern Community College. He's one of the board members of the new museum. He's also the great-grandson of Frank Keeney, who led striking miners in the Paint Creek-Cabin Creek strike of 1912 and 1913. These were some of the bloodiest battles of the Mine Wars.
The first time I heard my great-grandfather's name was, I was around 8 or 9 years old, and it was my great-aunt's house. And it was just a family gathering, and I was actually out back behind her house, throwing a little toy knife into the side of the hill, you know, trying to throw one into the side of the moss. And an old man walked up to me and said to me, "You have to learn how to throw that thing well, because you never know, you might have a Baldwin-Felts thug after you one day." And I had no idea what this guy was talking about. I didn't even know who he was. And so I asked him, what's a Baldwin-Felts thug, and why would they be after me? And he said, "Well, don't you know that you're Frank Keeney's great-grandson?"
During the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strikes, Baldwin-Felts agents were sent to fight the striking miners. After the strike, Frank Keeney became the president of the West Virginia UMWA in 1917. He then led miners in the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921. But Frank Keeney had blood on his hands, and historians generally did not name him a hero. He was tried for treason and murder, and until recently, the story of the Mine Wars was largely uncelebrated, even by the UMWA.
So, I mean, there's enormous chunks of our history that are just missing. It's no wonder the people in the state have an identity crisis. We don't know our own story. If you don't know your own story, how can you determine what you are?
That's why the local community and volunteers far and wide have come together to build the Mine Wars Museum. The funds to build the museum came from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the United Mine Workers of America, the National Coal Heritage Area, Turn This Town Around, and hundreds of private donations. And the museum, like the history, means different things for different people. Wilma Lee Steele says she hopes the museum will become a place where people throughout the coal fields can come to reclaim their identity.
I think that we have a lot to say, and I think we're going to say it. We're going to tell our history, and we're going to come together as a community.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Matewan.
The song you heard in that story was written about the Mine Wars, Fire in the Hole. By the way, there's a restaurant in Matewan called Wingo's that I hear serves great pulled pork sandwiches. And there's a little bed and breakfast in downtown Matewan that sleeps up to 30 people. It's a very small and out-of-the-way place, but if you want to travel somewhere that's deep in the heart of Appalachia, Matewan might just be what you're looking for. And beginning this weekend, the museum will be open on Saturdays and Sundays. It's located in downtown Matewan, and here again is a clip by Elaine Perkey singing Fire in the Hole, written by the late Hazel Dickens.
Daddy died a miner, Grandpa he did too. I'll bet this coal will kill me before my working days are through. In a hole that's dark and dirty, an early grave confined, I plan to make a union for the ones I leave behind. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. Fire in our hearts and fire in our souls, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole. No, there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
Perkey also hosts a radio show based out of Logan County called the Wallace Horn Friendly Neighbor Show. They've been on the air continuously for 48 years now. Redneck is a name that often comes with a negative meaning. A hot-headed person eager to pick a fight and cause trouble, perhaps. But as we heard earlier, the name originated in West Virginia as part of the Mine Wars. This week, for What's in a Name, we're going to do something a little different. So, we usually hear the story of folklore behind the name of a place in Appalachia. This week, we'll find out the story behind the word redneck, told by a storyteller named Bob Day, telling us his version of the story of the Battle of Blair Mountain.
I don't know about you, but whenever I think about the battles on American soil, I think of fights like the one in Trenton, Yorktown, Antietam, and Gettysburg, just to name a few. But, anybody heard of Blair Mountain? I ain't talking about the witch movie either. Blair Mountain, West Virginia, 1921. I'm Bob Day, and I'll be right back with another great American story. Somewhere around 12,000 pro-Union coal miners battled largely impregnable defensive mountain positions of 2,000 private detectives and or mercenaries who were acting in the very vested interests of the coal kings of the time. Maddened by years of simmering tensions, especially given the notable Sid Hatfield was murdered. Either way, this was no small battle. Yes, even airstrikes using a combination of gas and high-explosive munitions were employed, compliments of General Billy Mitchell and the state of Maryland. The air assault using old World War I ordnance had its effect against those working-class private citizens of largely Irish stock, I might add. Sporadic firefights continued for a week, and in the end, 30 were killed defending the mountain. Whereas, all told, close to 100 were killed and hundreds more injured on both sides. And that's not to mention the 985 miners who were indicted for a host of murder charges, for which many were convicted and imprisoned. Obviously, the big coal kings of that time would prevail until 1935, when Roosevelt led and passed protection for unionists. Now, don't get me wrong, I am not here to defend Roosevelt's policy or unions. Not me. Nonetheless, these rebels, many of whom were prestigious Irish heroes with heritages dating back to our founding wars and especially the Civil War, left yet another tremendous legacy despite their horrific defeat. But keep in mind, it wasn't all Irish, just mostly. Not to mention the exceedingly dangerous and truly heroic work of that time, which literally fueled our nation and deserves the greatest respect. The work in the mines back then was far worse than any of us can imagine. And on the trivial side of this very bloody, evil, and epic battle, while the Unionists were charging that mountain and dodging airstrikes and sniper fire by way of the federal government and coal interests, they all pulled out their red scarves and tied them around their necks, not only as a way of identifying each other, but as a badge of honor. And out of that small but bloody piece of American history arose the great American term, redneck. And I myself am honored to be called the same. Hail the redneck, the defender of our individual struggle dating back several centuries, even all the way back into Celtic culture. Don't take my word for it. Check it out. I'm Bob Day. And I've just told you another great American story. And if you enjoyed it, you just might be a redneck.
So that's one story of what's in the name, redneck. I always thought it described a person who just got a little too much sun on their neck and had the tan line to prove it. I've also heard it referenced to come from Native Americans because of the color of their skin. But as for the bandana, there are lots more stories about the significance. While in college, my sorority touted the red bandana also as a symbol of unity. So what's yours? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag what's in a name. Oh, and special thanks to Bob Day for that story about the redneck. We hope to be hearing more stories from him here on Inside Appalachia. His Twitter handle is at BobDayTGAS. Here in Appalachia, there are plenty of folks that embrace the term redneck. It's common in this area to see a truck with the word across the windshield, but others haven't always embraced the term. History professor Chuck Keeney says there are other stereotypes about Appalachians. They may have started because of the mine wars, and these stereotypes continue to this day.
All of these things that happened, the media and the powers that be explained away these violent incidents by saying that this violence was the result of a backward, isolated, feuding, moonshine-driven mountain culture. And to say that the violence was inherent in the culture and their backwardness and they were in the way of progress, it was a way of explaining the violence without delving into the real causes. And so the stereotypes that became associated with Appalachia go back to that. And understanding that original history, understanding that the word redneck actually meant labor solidarity, and it meant diversity, as opposed to being a running joke or a reason for Jeff Foxworthy to make more money, you know, or a reason to belittle a region. And it is flipping those stereotypes and looking at the reality and the nuances of the history, which give us a clearer identity and I think gives us a much more regional pride.
That was historian Chuck Keeney, whose great-grandfather, the union organizer Frank Keeney, and 550 of his fellow miners were indicted for murder and treason after the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain. Many of them, including Keeney, were acquitted. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Well, love us as you ride. Oh, yes, we ride. Newborn baby born last night. Walking, talking for daylight. Care to the mountain, boys. Care to the mountain. right.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we've been talking a little about one of the most pivotal events in American labor history, the West Virginia Mine Wars. The Mine Wars were a series of violent strikes by coal miners in southern West Virginia during the early 1900s. The 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain is often called the climax of the Mine Wars. We heard a little bit about Blair earlier when we heard how the term redneck first became used to reference the striking miners. During that battle, the United Mine Workers of America sent weapons and ammunition to help the striking miners. Now we're going to hear more about the army of miners that came to southern West Virginia to fight for the right to unionize. This is an excerpt from a 1985 documentary about the West Virginia Mine Wars called Even the Heavens Weep.
About 2,000 or 3,000 men on top of the hill entrenched in with machine guns all along the top of the hill. And that my cousin had told me that they weren't going to let anybody pass. They would kill every fellow that attempted to cross that mountain.
Talking about shooting, you couldn't hear your ears for the bullets.
Thursday, September 1st, the miners believed that they could indeed go all the way. They had 10,000 men, three times the number that Chaffin had on his defensive line. And they thought they could storm up Blair Mountain through Logan, perhaps all the way to Mingo County.
He told all the men, that was all the miners, to turn their guns over to federal authorities. Said the federal authorities here, we're not going to violate federal laws. And had a meeting, a speech, and told them, and they turned their guns over. There was about a 40-ton car of guns, different kinds of guns, that they turned over to the federal government. When the federal government asked them to quit, they quit instantly because nobody wanted to fight the government. We was only fighting thugs.
And that was one of the most significant events in the United Mine Workers' history in southern West Virginia. And the miners considered that a victory because they had made the United States government come to southern West Virginia and say, we're here to keep the peace. They felt that was a victory.
You were just hearing about miners who fought agents that were hired by coal companies during the March on Logan and the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921. That clip was from a film called Even the Heavens Weep. So why don't more people in Appalachia know about the Mine Wars? I'll admit, the topic of labor isn't the easiest thing to talk about. For some of us, it's too contentious. Even today, the UMWA carries a lot of emotional weight whenever you bring it up in conversation, especially here in the coalfields. Dr. Harvard Ayers is an anthropology professor at Appalachian State University. He thinks the events during the Mine Wars were left out of history books intentionally.
And in fact, it was the second largest insurrection, armed insurrection, only to our Civil War. Yet we hear very little bit about it. People have almost not heard of it because the coal companies want to keep it out of the books, out of the history books. And the importance of it was these people were fighting for things like constitutional and basic human rights, the rights to assemble, the rights to say things that they believed without the so-called gun thugs, the Baldwin Felts agents of the coal companies who would rough you up if they thought you were even thinking about joining a union or you were complaining in any way about the coal companies.
That was anthropology professor Harvard Ayers. Thanks to Michael and Carrie Klein from Talking Across the Lines for that audio. We don't even know for sure how many miners were killed during the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921. A lot of the fighters weren't even documented employees at their mines. They were African-American migrants from the South or immigrants from Italy and Eastern Europe. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. Oh, yes, you are. And isn't it awesome? By the way, here's an interesting anecdote about the new Mine Wars Museum. According to Chuck Keeney, a special guest showed up to check out the new museum, someone who's known as a strong anti-union force in the coal fields, the former CEO of Massey Energy.
Don Blankenship stopped by. I wasn't there at the time, so I missed him. And he stopped by and spoke some with Wilma Steele. Wilma and he went to high school together, interestingly enough. And Wilma was an art teacher for a long time in Mingo County. And so she was outside painting. And he came up and inquired about the museum and had a few questions and then drove off. So that was an interesting visit. Wasn't quite expecting Mr. Blankenship to stop by. But I like that. That tells me that people are noticing. And I want people to notice. I want people to be curious. I want you to come. And if you don't agree with what you see, well, then okay, let's talk about it.
That was history professor Chuck Keeney talking about the new Mine Wars Museum in Matewan, West Virginia, which he says was visited by former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship a few weeks ago before the grand opening. Blankenship is facing federal charges related to the Upper Big Branch mine disaster that killed 29 miners. Blankenship did respond to our email, but said he couldn't speak publicly. But we'll hear from him in the second half of our show, and we'll revisit a story about a union strike he helped break in the 1980s. I'm Jessica Lilly, you're Inside Appalachia. On our show today, we've been talking about the mine wars in the early 1900s. Now we're going to jump forward a bit to hear more about a labor strike from the 1980s. That's when a strike by the United Mine Workers of America against Massey first put Don Blankenship's name in the national news and helped fuel his rise up the chain of company command. WMMT's Parker Hobson sent us a story about that strike.
On October 1st, 1984, the United Mine Workers of America began a strike against what was then known as the A.T. Massey Coal Company. In hopes of maximizing profits and weakening the UMWA, Massey had held out and refused to sign the union's latest national contract, one that the union felt guaranteed better safety and health standards for miners. So the UMWA went on strike at select Massey operations, including at the Sprouse Creek Processing Plant in Mingo County, West Virginia. In 1986, Apple Shop created a film about this strike called Mine War on Blackberry Creek, and all of the audio you'll hear in this piece comes from this film. You'll hear the voice of director Ann Lewis asking questions, as well as the voices of local residents, strikebreakers hired by Massey, and many striking miners themselves.
Y'all work here?
We used to. Now we picket here for the last 8 months. Our forefathers shedded their blood for this. There ain't no way we're going to let our old pensioners down. They depend on us.
A.T. Massey is one of the rottenest companies that they are in the world. That's just that simple. They want to be the top dog on everything, and they want you to profit.
Do you think that Massey, because they cut us back to, say, $8 or $9 an hour, that they would cut their coal, say, from $35? 28, try to help out the economy? No. In fact, they'd probably be wanting to cut us and raise their prices.
The Sprouse Creek plant was operated by a subsidiary of Massey called Rawls Sales and Processing. The president of Rawls was a young accountant who had only been with Massey for about 2 years. His name was Don Blankenship.
This area has a history of
Union terrorism.
Is that the way you see it?
Mm-hmm. A.T. Massey Coal Company and many other coal companies have huge investments in southern West Virginia, including property and coal mines and preparation plants and mining equipment. And if we cannot agree under what terms the employees are going to work, that we still have our right to work, and that that's clearly spelled out in the laws, and that there are people who will exercise that right.
You got Tommy Copley. He used to be a city cop in Williamson, make one both. You got Ricky Starr, used to be a city cop. They laid their badges down and went over here and took badges for Massey.
Blankenship and Massey had brought in non-union workers, referred to by the striking miners as scabs, to keep operations running at Sprouse Creek. Some of these strikebreakers were actually former police officers, which was a part of Blankenship's larger plan to fortify the property, a plan that included barbed wire fences, armed guards, attack dogs, and surveillance cameras that filmed picketers and nearby residents.
Ray Scabs here from Oklahoma. It's a pretty far-reaching effect this thing's having, you know. Their dog compound with their old killer-trained dogs is just straight ahead here behind this little camper that you see down here in the corner of this compound. And they've got 2 miles of chain-link fence put up.
This used to be a nice place to live. It's a nice neighborhood. It looks more so like a concentration camp now than it does a coal mine. Everything's behind fence, armed guards running up and down the road. And they, actually, in my mind, they act like they're above the law.
The strike started relatively peacefully at Sprouse Creek, with hundreds regularly gathering for sit-ins and demonstrations that sometimes even included sermons. But in the militarized environment that Blankenship helped create, as the months wore on, things got tense. There were reports of stones thrown over the fence, strikebreakers' cars being attacked with baseball bats, and nails left on the road to puncture tires. Gunshots were reportedly fired into Blankenship's office. Emotions ran high on all sides.
They don't care about your families. They don't care about your babies. They don't care about your husband. They don't care about your wife. And Mr. Politician, we want them out of here on the same horse they rode in on. Bless God, we want them out of here.
This is America. They say this is America, and they're living in Poland, and we're the Poland people, but we're the one being ordered to do stuff, and they're trying to force us to do something that we're not wanting to do. So as far as I'm concerned, this union is no profit or no benefit to no person.
You know, if you don't like working a union mine, you work non-union. You work unsafe, and you let the boss kick you in the rear end anytime he gets ready, and he comes in and tells you when you're working, not if you want to work overtime. And, you know, if people like that, well, hey, if that's their thing, shoot your best shot. But don't be coming in here crossing a picket line.
I went down to Raw Sales and got a job of contracting, putting up a fence. One thing just led to another. And since then, I've been trucking this coal. Now, they can shoot me today. I don't care, but they better kill me when they do.
What's up?
Because I'll show them how to kill. I'll show them what it's all about.
But despite all of the unrest, Blankenship said that Sprouse Creek was still making money during the strike, because essentially they could pay the non-union replacement workers less and work them harder, and because they didn't have to worry about stopping work for potentially unsafe conditions.
The fact of the matter is our costs, despite that strike damage, are equal to or less what they were before the strike. Just a large number of reasons. But what you've got, when you're running the kind of volume we run at 200,000 tons a month, then when you throw into that the fact that we are able to better manage and we don't have any work stoppages in the meantime and we don't have a problem with getting a guy that normally runs a roof boulder to do something else for us where in the union he might say he ain't going to do that, you know, that's more than made up for the strike damage.
200,000 tons a month out of Sprouse Creek?
A lot of coal for a strike.
Since Massey was still making money, they could basically hold out for as long as they wanted. This wore away at the union's leverage, and after 15 long months, the UMWA gave in just before Christmas in 1985. It asked its members to go back to work, and those able to return were forced to work under the same conditions as the non-union strikebreakers. In the end, some 400 union miners were permanently fired, and the UMWA was defeated.
Our people, at the request of President Trump, chose to go back to work unconditionally. Eventually, we're going to win, but it's just terrible that they have to work with those scabs. They put me in some good class here. They fired Bill and Frank and I. You know, of course, they fire a lot of our people, too.
One thing that would definitely get you a contract without a shadow of a doubt is to shut the coal down permanent and not let them run none at all. But the money and resources that Massey had, it's real difficult to do that.
If you're not union and you're able to pay a comparable benefit payment, it might cost you 20% of what the union pension plan costs you. What that means is not that I'm in for or against that. What that means is that non-union competitors have a tremendous advantage, and therefore they sell coal cheaper and drive union coals out of business, union coal operations out of business.
Now I ain't worth two pennies. My lungs is gone. I've lost an eye. I've lost a kidney. When the big money come in, they had to take me out of the mines. Now, they're a rich company. They got plenty of money. They was paying union wages, and they made big money. They just want to take all of it. They don't want poor people to have none of it. They want it all. They're greedy.
A man goes in the mine for 20 years. He comes out of that coal mine, and to walk down the street in Williamson or the shopping mall, he has to have a bottle of oxygen in a shopping cart in front of him. Somebody owes that man something. And Massey definitely doesn't want to face up to that responsibility.
What you have to accept in a capitalist society generally is that I always make the comparison, it's like a jungle where a jungle's survival of the fittest. Unions, communities, people, everybody's going to have to learn to accept that in the United States you have a capitalist society, and that capitalism, from a business viewpoint, is survival of the most productive.
All the company cares for is, as long as you're making them a dollar, they're patting you on the back and you're the finest fella in the world. You stick your head out from under the, out and under that rock and get covered up. You know, there's another man standing in line waiting for your job. That's the way it is in these non-union outfits.
My dad was fighting them for the same thing I'm fighting for now. A decent wage, a little dignity and a living. And I see this battle going on for a lifetime. I don't think my dad wanted me to be a coal miner. And I didn't particularly want to be a coal miner. But that's where the money was at.
You wouldn't work non-union.
First mine I ever worked in was non-union, but I couldn't get a job anywhere else. I didn't have any experience. I was running a cutting machine, and I'd parked the cutter off to the side in a break, and I was sitting there drinking coffee, and there was a curtain up. The superintendent, the section boss, was on the other side of the curtain. And I heard the boss and the superintendent, they were just having a bull session. I heard him tell the superintendent, he said, "You know, Dave," he said, "my one ambition in life is to work some poor son of a bitch to death." I sat there for a few minutes and I'd probably I got to thinking, you know, that I was that guy that he'd been treating that way. But that was the last day in an union mine.
Following his success in this strike, Don Blankenship's star was on the rise. In 1992, he was promoted to CEO of Massey after just 10 years at the company. As chief executive, he aggressively expanded operations, kept costs low, made friends with local politicians and judges, and continued to fight the UMWA, whose membership declined steadily across the country as more and more companies followed Massey's lead and went non-union. But from the year 2000 to 2009, more American coal miners were killed at Massey Mines than at any other company. And in April of 2010, 29 miners were killed at once in a massive methane explosion at Massey's Upper Big Branch mine in Raleigh County, West Virginia.
That was Parker Hobson from WMMT. The audio clips you heard were from the film Mine War on Blackberry Creek by Ann Lewis. You can watch the entire documentary for free on Apple Shop's website, and we posted the link on our website at wvpublic.org.
Harlan County Blues, talking about the strife of the union man. A bunch of fellas the other day oared a Harlan wind. They told me about the fun they had and all the time in jail they'd spend. All the other fellas were like me who didn't go along. If you want the story, boys, just listen to this song. None of the boys didn't like it much. They said they's treated bad. They took their knives, their pocketbooks, or anything they had. You didn't have to be drunk, they said, to get throwed in the can. The only thing you needed to be was just a union man. And they was throwing all sorts of union boys in there that day. Here's a few they threw in. Throwed Bill Wheeler in the can with all his pies and gases. He had no money to pay a fine, so they just took his glasses. Put Bill Sheets in the jailhouse for reckless walking, they say. They can't hold old Bill for that, 'cause he always walks that way.
Now we head over to Kentucky, where there are no longer any union coal mines. The state's few remaining union miners were laid off this past New Year's Eve when Patriot Coal's Highland Mine in western Kentucky shut down, the UMWA confirmed. Erica Peterson of WFPL in Louisville reports.
I'm a third-generation coal miner.
When Harlan County resident Deke Hampton went into coal mining in the 1970s, he didn't seek to join a union mine. It just happened.
And I was just raised in what you call union country. I guess you put it that way. It was a way of life.
Not anymore. Now, Kentucky's union miners are a relic of the past.
Appalachia was always a really tough nut for the union to crack, and I think Kentucky was maybe the toughest of them all.
Labor historian James Green says, in retrospect, the fight to unionize Harlan County's Brookside Mine in 1973 was one of the last stands for the union in the state. The struggle was immortalized in the Oscar-winning documentary Harlan County, USA.
Let's stand on our 2 feet and show these boys that we can help them get a contract. Let's show the people in Harlan County we stand together.
That's the world in which Deke Hampton began his career, working for union stronghold U.S. Steel. Like Hampton, Quentin Clark is a third-generation coal miner, too.
Right now I work in the safety department. We take dust samples.
But Clark is 20 years younger than Hampton, 41 years old, and lives in Hopkins County in western Kentucky. He says he's never considered joining a union, and that's an attitude shared by most of his peers.
When you throw in union dues that you're required to pay, you throw in the fact that someone else can determine whether you work or whether you do not work. You know, there's a lot of factors that keep the younger guys from even considering it.
This is a nationwide trend that applies to unions of all types. The Bureau of Labor Statistics notes that in 1983, 20% of American workers belonged to some sort of labor union. By 2014, that number had fallen to 11%.
I think it's more, in some ways, the unions have won the contest that they were fighting decades ago.
Bill Bissett is the president of the Kentucky Coal Association, which represents many of the state's coal operators.
Coal miners are now paid very well. They have excellent benefits. They have many ways that they can inform the regulators of any concerns they have anonymously. So the union representation, I don't think, is seen as needed as it was in the past for our industry.
Regardless, mine safety attorney and former regulator Tony Opegard says there's still a role for the coal miners' union.
It's much harder for a miner at a non-union mine to stand up for safety.
Opegard says, in theory, federal safety laws mean coal miners can't be discriminated against for refusing to work in unsafe conditions. But in practice, those laws are lacking.
Miners don't see the need for a union. Now, where they see the need for a union is when they get hurt and the company then treats them like a disposable commodity.
There's a lack of impartial data about the relative safety of union and non-union mines, just anecdotal stories. Predictably, union and non-union miners tend to disagree on this point.
But I'm not going to say it's like night and day difference.
After a few years as a union miner in Harlan County, Deke Hampton worked decades as a state mine inspector until retiring in 2009. He says there were starker differences between mines run by big companies and smaller operators. But on a whole, he found that union mines tended to be the safest.
Some of the big companies that I inspected, they provided safety for the miners, but not on the scale of the union, because the men dictated what was safe and what wasn't.
Hopkins County coal miner Quentin Clark says, as far as he's concerned, the advantages to joining a union today aren't really about safety.
It's not a safety issue anymore, is what I'm saying. It's not a, we're talking about a dollar or two an hour, maybe. Is that what they want to try to get, or a day or two off a year? It's not as significant as it used to be.
And if he's approached tomorrow by union organizers, Clark still wouldn't be interested.
I would tell him, thank you, appreciate it, but no.
The United Mine Workers of America declined to comment for this story. I'm Erica Peterson in Louisville.
Whitney Jones from member station WKMS also contributed to that story. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
The old pirates and brigands who fought hand to hand, who would scuttle ship or pillage the land, have formed a collusion and all come ashore, and now ply their trade through the company store. But when these old worthies are called to their doom, I think honest business will enjoy a great boom. And when they are finally called from our shore, I hope they'll take with them the company store.
Today on our show, we've been talking about the history of people in the coal fields who have clashed over their views on whether miners should join labor unions. This show is in honor of a new museum about the mine wars that just opened down in Matewan, West Virginia. More info on that museum is on our website, wvpublic.org. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. On today's show, we've been talking about how today more and more union coal mines are disappearing. And we heard about how a remote coal town in Mingo County, West Virginia, is hoping to hold on to its history and, frankly, its ability to survive in this modern age. They're investing in its labor history to take them into the future. But let's face it, Appalachia has changed dramatically in the last 50 to 100 years. Just driving down to Mingo County, where the new museum is located, you really feel the fading towns and cities, almost fading into the backdrop of the mountains. It's surreal. Many places in Appalachia are. It's sad, true to many people who remember the thriving economy here when coal was booming. But there was life here in Appalachia even before coal began to be mined. Time marches relentlessly on. Many philosophers say the only guarantee in this life is change. In fact, you don't have to drive far in Appalachia to find remnants of former prehistoric societies whose heyday in this region has long since faded from memory. Actually, one photographer is trying to capture glimpses of those ancient times in a series he's dubbed Vanishing Points. Glynis Board spoke with him about his work and brings us this report.
Michael Sherwin is an associate professor of photography at West Virginia University. When he moved to Morgantown with his family several years ago, there were these protests happening around the development of what is now the Suncrest Town Center. WVU had sold what was an ancient indigenous burial site to developers. Sherwin entered the scene after the Super Kroger was already built.
And being that it was less than a mile from my house and I was shopping there, I was kind of torn by this whole, like, dual identity of this landscape. And so one evening, I decided I wanted to photograph it.
Sherwin says historical landscapes have always fascinated him. He shoots with a large format camera, like the one Ansel Adams used, which he says there's a mystery to the process that he enjoys, a break from the world of immediate gratification that we're all pretty accustomed to.
There's a mystery as to how that image is going to work out, and there's an anticipation that I really enjoy, and I never really know what I'm going to get until I scan that film into the computer, and then it's processed from there.
So he hauled his camera to an overlook of the growing shopping center on the edge of Morgantown, the almost final resting place of some of the Monongahela tribe. In a strange twist of fate, the bones found there were entrusted to a tribe in New York who, Sherwin says, were great enemies of the Monongahela tribe. Be that as it may, Sherwin composed the shot of the shopping center and then processed the negative.
I photographed it around dusk. It was a long exposure, so the clouds were kind of moving above, and then below the cars were, you know, the hustle and bustle of this little town center. And when I saw the print of that, after I scanned that negative in, I was like, whoa, there's a duality to this image that expresses these two different cultures, the East and the West, kind of coming together.
It was the beginning of what became a series Sherwin named Vanishing Points. He began to research what ancient remnants of lost civilizations in the region still exist, then to seek them out and photograph them. He canvassed much of the state of West Virginia and then began to follow the ancient Ohio Trail in central and southern Ohio. Over the course of more than 3 years, he's been collecting historical landscapes. Images in the resulting series usually incorporates some strangely banal detail of modern society that coexists with some former society's faded mark on the landscape.
And so this is a canal lock in Black Hand Gorge State Park in Ohio that was carved into an earthwork. So the earthwork banks were above this, and they literally carved into them to create a lock for water and for boat travel. And now it's, you know, it's not in use. Now it's a hiking trail. So you have three sort of layers, three different kinds of dimensions to the landscape.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Then some of Sherwin's images show no trace of former society at all.
One of the things I've gotten interested in is not just photographing the mound and documenting the site, but thinking about how the landscape looks and how different it is from the viewpoint, from the top of the site. So this is from the top of Grave Creek Mound, which is the largest known Indian burial mound in the world. And it's incredible and massive, thousands of years old. And this is the view from the top of Moundsville, West Virginia.
Sherwin's series includes some 60 images so far. He says it's an ongoing project, but he's at a point now where putting a large show together might be possible. And by large, I mean literally large. One of the benefits of shooting with a large format camera is this incredible detail that's captured, allowing really big prints, like 3 or 4 feet tall. Putting a show together of these huge prints is something he's hoping to achieve in coming years in this region. His project so far was made possible in part with grants from the Colonel Eugene E. Myers Foundation, the West Virginia Division of Culture and History, and the National Endowments for the Arts, and with approval from the West Virginia Commission of the Arts. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
To see some of the images Michael Sherwin has captured, you can visit us online at wvpublic.org. And if you know of some vanishing points in your neck of the woods, we'd love to see them. Send us a tweet at @InAppalachia, #vanishingpoints. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Talking Across the Lines, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, and The Great American Story with Bob Day. Music in today's show was provided by Elaine Perkey and the Wallace Horn Friendly Neighbor Show with Fire in the Hole, Hazel Dickens, and the following musicians from the album Blair Pathways: Jamie Laval, Sarah Lynch Thomason, Liam Michael Skye, Ash Devine, Brian Claflin, Samuel Gleaves, Myra Morrison, Jordan Engel, Reverend Robert Jones, Dom Flemons, Tim Erickson, and Riley Bogus. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at @WVJessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.